in Perek Dala. We're in chapter 4 in Malachim. And I wanted to just go back to that weird story about Elichoreph and Achiyah, these two scribes of Shlomo, or two out of three scribes, according to Abarbanel, and their fate, quite literally, at the hands of the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death. For those who weren't here last time, they're just in the middle of the description of Shlomo's bureaucracy. We find these two scribes, they seem to be minding their own business, and then we get a story from the Gemara in which we are told that in one form or another, there's a Babylonian Talmud version, there's the Rishalmi version, Shlomo, King Solomon, finds out that the angel of death wants to kill them. He sends them far away. In the Babylonian Talmud version, he sends them to the city of Luz, and that's a city where people don't die, according to Midrash. And either way, the angel of death gets them in the place that he sent them. Because you can't outwit the angel of death. It doesn't matter if you're Shlomo HaMelech, if you're King Solomon. And last time I tried to give a couple of bases for this in the text, something to try to hint at something, but it's really hard to do. And I just wanted to add four links for you in sort of on the sheet. Just things that came up as I was looking beyond traditional sources to try to find something. One is that the name Elichoreph itself is a very odd name. We have lots of names that start with Eli, reference to Hashem, to God, but Choreph doesn't really fit. So I found the first article that I gave you there on JSTOR, the year eponymate in the Hebrew calendar, which has a whole discussion basically saying that Elichoreph may have been an officer in charge of the calendar. That's what it comes down to, and he tries to play with Choreph in that regard. The second one that I have there is someone who argues, this is just, it comes up along the way in a book, that the name may have been Egyptian. Interestingly, I also found in the course of looking for Elichoreph that it's a popular name today, but not in Jewish circles. If you look for Elichoreph, you can find South Americans with that name. You can find it in the Philippines. It's a biblical name, and they like biblical names. Maybe we're just, you know, in our community, we're just too narrow. And then the next one is actually, I had Rose in mind with this one. This is the third bullet point in source number one, is a book written in 1898 in Afrikaans. The book is The Queen of Sheba. And they tell of the discovery of an ancient scroll written by Elichoreph, Solomon's scribe. So that's one of interest. And then the last one was the one I was really looking for. This story is so classic. The story in the Talmud is so classic that it can't only appear in our literature. It's one of those that must appear elsewhere as well. And sure enough, there's a Persian story called The Man Who Flew to Hindustan. And it involves Shlomo, King Solomon, trying to save someone from the angel of death. It seems to be based on our story. I also understand there's a similar story in Indian literature. There are other cases where stories appear in the Talmud that have parallels in other cultures. So there's a whole discussion in Maseches Tamid of Alexander the Great meeting the sages and having a dialogue with them in which he asks them all sorts of questions and they answer in wise ways. And there are parallels to that in other cultures as well. And knowing Shlomo, King Solomon, as somebody who is cross-cultural, all these other cultures also say things about him. It's not surprising that you're going to see this story elsewhere. So there I gave you a link to an article that talks about the man who flew to Hindustan. So none of that explains at all where this is coming from in our text. Like, still, why are we picking on these two people? Like, you know, of all the people, except that they're associated with Shlomo. But nonetheless, it's a fascinating story, that's for sure. Okay, we're going further. So we are up to chapter 4, and the section that runs from sentences 7 to 19, with the 12 officers who are administrators. And each one is in charge of a month of the year, and we'll see what their role is in a moment. But the main point in this section is that supporting the monarchy of Shlomo is a very expensive endeavor. And so each month you have a different person from a different part of the land who is in charge of providing, well, what sounds like at first support for Shlomo and his government, financial support, food support. However, Don Isaac Abarbanel says it's more sophisticated than that. If you take a look at source number 2, and again, he's on his experience in royal courts. So he says, V'amefarshim kaslu shahayu elu govim hamas ba'aratzos u'mechalkalim es hamelach ve'es beiso. He says the commentators have written that these 12 officials we're going to read about collected taxes in the different lands, and then they would support the king and his household. A very simple read. Ve'ena kasuv me'id al zeh, but he says the text doesn't say that. V'haya inyana nitzivim ha'ela v'tzorcham. He says, you want to know what these officials are about. You want to know what the need is for them. L'fi sheShlomo higdil kavod ha'malchus ad l'mala. Shlomo has elevated the honor, the status of his reign way up to heaven. V'hayu lo kemoshe yizkor parashim rabim v'susim harbe. He had lots of charioteers. He had lots of horses. And because of that, everybody's eating at his table. The animals are in his stables. And because he has power not just in Israel, but over many nations, as we're going to see, the result of that is that he has visitors all the time from the ends of the earth. Mehem magishim and chalafanav, some of them come to bring gifts. Mehem lishmo es chochmaso, some of them want to hear his wisdom. Ubavurze, hayat tamid ribui anashim va'am kilashono holchim acharei hamelech. You always had lots of people from lots of lands in his entourage. Uchdei shalo yichabdu mizonosav al ha'aretz asher yashafa. In order to avoid a situation in which providing food for him becomes too great a burden for wherever it is that he is staying, because as we'll see, Abarbanel believes he may be traveling place to place. And you don't want food to become very expensive. If suddenly, if Shlomo is in Toronto, and there's a need for Toronto to provide food for him, then the price of food goes up in the marketplace overall. And there's a concern about shortages. So his chakem Shlomo l'sader b'chol ha'aretz nitzivim shayu konim mimemon hamelach hamizonos v'adver matzrichim lebeis hamelach b'kamus gadol maspik. He says the job of the nitzivim was not to take money from the nation to buy food for Shlomo, but to take Shlomo's own funds. And, I mean, funds that he had gotten from the nation anyway, but to take the resources that he has and use it to buy food and whatever he needs. And to send that food to the place where the king is. And each of these officers has a month when that's their job. He says, this way you support the king from each area without overburdening a particular area, without making the prices skyrocket in a particular area. So each area is going to shoulder the burden 1 month out of the year. And then he goes on to say, in the last line, V'ulai Shlomo haya menhago tamid l'sheves izman ha'kayitz b'mechoz echad na'osei lav u'b'chor b'mechoz echad achero u'l'sheves bo. Could be that Shlomo's practice was that he had one place he stayed in the summer, one place he stayed in the winter, and you know that that was the practice of Persian kings, it was the practice of Roman kings. So maybe Shlomo did that too with the different seasons. So the idea is not simply collect money from different places around the country to support Shlomo. Rather, it's a method of distributing the burden around the land in order to ease the responsibility for the nation as a whole. You follow? That's what he says these administrators are doing. Now, each administrator is going to be listed with a different location. Radak and others say, even though there are 12 of them, that doesn't mean each one is from a different tribe. When you look at the locations that they're in, it's just not so. Let's take a look at the parak. Let's see the verses themselves. Chapter 4, sentence 7. Vili Shlomo Shemasar Nitzavim al Kol Yisrael. He has these 12 officials. You see it go back and forth between Nitzavim, as the text has it here, as a Nitz and Nitzivim. It means those who stand, those who have a position of responsibility. V'chilkilu es hamelach v'es beiso, they feed, they support the king and his household. Chodesh bashana yiyeh al ha'echad ha'chakel, each one has to support 1 month a year. Ve'ele shemosam, and here are their names. Ben Chur, Bahar Ephraim. Ben Chur is his name. Son of Chur. On Mount Ephraim. Mount Ephraim is a big area, of course. The Radak says we don't mention his first name. We just call him the son of Hur because he was better known via his father. You may be familiar in the Mishnah and the Gemara, they talk about Ben Azai and Ben Zoma. And the understanding is that those are people who achieved their status when they were still young and everybody knew their father and therefore they get named that way. I see my internet connection is unstable. I'm having an issue here. I'm supposed to have wired internet on this laptop and the wire is not working. So I'm not on that. I hope that we'll still be okay. But the idea here is that Shlomo is being supported by these people. And yeah, Ben-Hur is somebody who gets his status when he's young. I should note on this, because I was curious when I saw it. Yes, this is the origin of the character in the movie. If you take a look at source number 3, from the source of all truth, Wikipedia, Lew Wallace, who was the novelist, wrote that he chose the name Ben-Hur because it was biblical and easily spelled, printed, and pronounced. I guess he didn't choose Eli Choref. He saw Eli Choref and he kept right on going. But he found a winner in Ben-Hur. Okay. So these are the officers. I'm not going to go through each one of the officers. I wanted to get to Ben-Hur in particular, but I did want to note for you, in sentence 11, we list Ben Avinadav from Nafas Dor, Tafas Bas Shlomo Haisalo Isha. He married a daughter of Shlomo. So first of all, this is interesting because I didn't know anything about his kids besides Rechavam, who becomes the next king. Now I get the name of a daughter. If you go further along to sentence 15, you find Achimaatz in Naphtali, and he marries Basmat, Bat Shlomo, Leisha. Basmat is an interesting name in its own right. That's one that we know from Bereishis. But these are daughters of Shlomo, and Abarbanel says, the way it works, I see your hand, the way it works is that these appointments of the 12 people happen in the beginning of Shlomo's reign. At the time of Shlomo's reign, he does not have a daughter of marriageable age. So first they have these positions, and then later on, they end up marrying Shlomo's daughters. That seems to be the way that this works. Okay. I'm going to hold your questions for just a moment longer because I just wanted to show you sentence 19, which is something we discussed prematurely last week. So I wanted to come back to it here. At the end of the list, after mentioning someone from Gilad, we are then told, Unitziv echad asher ba'aretz. There was a nitziv in the land broadly. So if you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Rav Yehuda and Rav Nachman debate what is the job of this one who is in the land. One says, Charam ar echad mamuna al kulam. One said it was an officer who was appointed over all the other 12. V'charam ar keneged chodesh ha'ibur. And the other one says he's there for the leap months. The leap month is not a new phenomenon. It's very important for people to remember. Aside from the fact that we are told already about the Jewish calendar and about the month that we get out of Egypt being the first of the months and so on already in Shmos, in general, just for our own knowledge, especially since it's a leap year this year, and we're announcing Adar Sheni, we are having Adar Sheni, I should say, starting on Friday. People should realize leap months were an ancient phenomenon beyond Jewish culture. It was beyond the Jews. Other cultures also had lunisolar calendars where they tried to match the lunar with the solar and therefore needed to make up the gap with a month every so often. It's the Muslims who have just the lunar calendar, but the lunisolar existed beyond ours. That's something that I think is worth understanding. So this person here, who is the Nitziv Echad Asher Ba'aretz, the Gemara says is either an overseer for the other 12 or is in charge of the leap months. But I wanted to show you a Barbanel. Remember, last week we showed 5 different parallels in a Barbanel parallels between what Shlomo does and what exists in the European monarchies that a Barbanel is familiar with. We saw a 5th one when we talked about the king traveling to different places for different seasons. So here, he shows you that this is also parallel. This extra officer is parallel to something that he is familiar with as Italian custom. If you take a look at source number 5, the Hebrew is on the bottom of one side, English is at the top of the next side. I'm going to just use my English translation here in the interests of time. He says, I think the simple meaning of why you have this extra officer is that King Solomon made 2 divisions regarding food. He arranged to provide sufficient food for his table, and because he needed other food for itinerants and for those who came to the king who were not his servants and who do not eat of his property, he needed to provide their food from the land where the king stayed. So you have all these other people who need to be fed. They're not part of his family. They're not part of his household or visitors. For this, there was an officer in the land who was appointed by the people of the city when the king came there to order people to sell food in the local market. And he would set an appropriate rate for the year. So the idea here is that, and thank you for your note, Moish, the idea here is that the Nitzivin are in charge of rustling up food from different areas in the country for Shlomo's household. And then you have this fellow whose job is to get from the place where Shlomo is situated for all the visitors and to make sure that the farmers are selling their stuff so that there will be an adequate supply. This officer was a local person who knew all the local people and their produce to compel them to sell it in the market, and therefore he is not named. For he was not appointed by the king. It was not always the same person identified for the role, but the local people appointed him each season. Wherever the king is, that's where they appoint somebody to play this role. That's the idea. And he says also today in Italy they do this. For aside from the king's officers who travel with him and are appointed over food, the city also appoints someone under their hand called Almotassin. And I don't know, if there's an analog to that in English. But that's the idea. So he says this extra nitziv, this extra officer who is not named, is a local who has the job of providing for the visitors to Shlomo. That's the idea. And that answers a big question, right? Abarbanel, in choosing this approach instead of the Gemara's approach, is explaining why this person is anonymous. Right? If the person is somebody in charge of the leap month or is overseeing all the others, why isn't he named? Everybody else got named. So Abarbanel's answer is that the person is not being named because it was a different person each time. that's the way that he will approach the problem. Okay. Ricky, you wanted to ask.
First of all, Shlomo would have had dozens and dozens of daughters, so I don't know how much of a yichus it is to marry one of his daughters. The other thing I was wondering, why is there such a huge amount of place given to all these people and these names and everything?
Right, so that goes back to what we said last week. In the beginning of chapter 4, we discussed this question of why we're giving them space. We talked about the view that biblical lists are poetic. It's a form of poetry in the Torah. We talked about the view that since this is the founding of the mighty Jewish reign, so therefore we're listing the founders. Just like in Ezra, we list the names of those who came back to Israel under Zerubbabel. We gave a few different explanations. If you go back to the recording from last week, you'll hear it there. I don't have the notes in front of me anymore, and I don't want to misquote. But yeah, now go back to the class from last week, and you'll hear more about that there. It's a good question, but we did say something.
About the daughters, he would have had dozens and dozens of children.
Yeah, dozens and dozens of sons also, and presumably with 1,000 wives. But the answer is still, anybody associated with Shlomo is special. You weren't there, I think, when we learned Ezra and Nehemiah, but we talked then about people who were descendants of Shlomo's servants, and they were considered to have a special status. You know, let alone people who were descendants of Shlomo personally. It's a big deal. Okay. Any other questions or comments on this part? Yes, Sandra.
I was just wondering, in order to live such a opulent, lavish life, was this a function of his intelligence or his traveling? Or David HaMelech Shaul, they did not live this type of life.
Right. So it's
for whatever reason.
Right. It's a good question, and it goes back to a point that I made at the beginning of the chapter, and I'm about to reiterate here, which is this is meant to highlight two things. It is meant to highlight Shlomo's abilities as king, the fact that he is wise and able to figure out how to administer the land like this, even as he's growing in stature, even as his kingdom is growing and his entourage is growing. That's one. And then the other is in order to show how God is fulfilling his promises to the nation, presenting them with a utopia in which, as we're about to read in sentence 20, everybody is prospering. This illustrates that prosperity. So that's another key factor that's driving our emphasis on having all of these officers. Moish.
Well, at that time, was the king of Mitzrayim or Koresh Melech, the
Zion
Melech, the neighboring, were they as rich and as ostentatious?
Nope, as you're going to see. You'll see. We're going to talk about, by the time we're done this year, we will have talked about both of them, but Hiram is coming right up in chapter 5. Moish.
Well, I just wanted to throw out an idea, and I wonder whether some form of this was used. I don't know how much of this goes on anymore, but when I was much younger, the King and Queen of England had a massive way of making money, which was, it was essentially a licensing, what they would use that. It was called by appointment. Actually, what I remember is Pall Mall cigarettes. And what you did was you basically gave X to the Queen's family, for which you got paid, and then you were able to use that by appointment next to the city on products that you sold to the citizenry.
Right.
And I'm just wondering whether some variation of this was used by the...
So the problem with that is that there's no evidence of it in the text. Meaning, they're presented very explicitly as being people who are bringing things, not people who are selling things. You know?
Yeah,
It says explicitly, if you go back to sentence 7, v'chilkelu es hamelach v'es beiso, they bring things for support, not paying money. They're bringing food. What you're talking about was a standard, you're right, a standard European licensing practice. You would sell liquor licenses, all of that. But it's not, that's a later invention. I don't think we certainly don't find any hint of it here. That's what I would say. There's a note in the chat asking about Abarbanel's evidence for the function of the officers. And the answer is, as I said when I introduced Abarbanel on this chapter, a lot of what he's saying is, as he does elsewhere, drawn from what he sees in the monarchies that he is a part of. He's part of the monarchy and part of the government in three different countries. And he's drawing on that to explain what he's seeing in the text. It's all founded in the text in the sense that it reads well with it. You can find support for it. But not every point that he's making is really based on the psukim. When he says, as an example, we were bothered in the beginning of the chapter when Azariah did not have a job. Right? If you go back to the beginning of the chapter in sentence 2, we said, here are his officers, Azariah ben Sadok HaKohen, without any role, and we discussed what his role might be. And then we said, Elichor and Achiah are Sofrim. And Abarbanel said, actually, based on what I've seen in government, you need three different scribes handling three different areas that scribes have responsibility in. And Azariah is one of the three scribes. It's Azariah, Licharef, and Achiyah. So it colors the way he reads the text. It's anchored in the way he reads the text. But it's fundamentally based on his own government experience. That's really what's driving what he's doing here, what Abarbanel is doing. Okay. So take a look, please, at Pasuk Chaf, at sentence 20. The end of this chapter, to a certain extent, though, a bridge into the next one. Yehuda v'Yisrael rabim, kachol asher al hayam larov. Yehuda and Yisrael, who are officially one kingdom, remember, but we've already seen how they were listed separately going back to Shmuel Aleph. Yehuda and Yisrael are like sand at the sea, there are so many of them. Ochlim v'shosim, Usmechim. They are eating, they are drinking, and they are happy. How do you like that? We like that. We're good with that. So what is the point of saying this? Malbin says it's in order to say, don't worry about all this infrastructure and overhead in Shlomo's government. If you look at source number 6, Malbin says, V'atayomar, now it says, that he could enlarge his table greatly. In terms of the nation which supports him, who are as many as the sand, they had so much. They had all they needed and more. Shakulam ochlim v'shosim usmechem. They're eating, they're drinking, they're being glad. Ubazel lo hichmir aleihem mitzidam. So therefore, he's not burdening them. The point of sentence 20 is to say, yeah, I know what you're worried about. Don't worry about it. It's okay. That's what we're trying to get out of this line. But there's more to that. I'm gonna have everybody wait with questions until the end of this unit. So please don't even put up a hand. I want to make sure people hear this. The other piece of this is, as I said in the beginning of the chapter and just reiterated in answering one of the questions before, this is about fulfillment of a divine promise. When you see the phrase, many like the sand, that should remind you of source number 7, Hashem's promise to Abraham that his descendants will be many like the sand at the sea. And not just that, but it's also a phrase that gets used later in Tanakh, and I gave you references there. Hopefully you have a Tanakh here, as I always ask you to please have a Tanakh, as opposed to just having a Malachim. I am opening mine, Yoshua chapter 11, sentence 4, in which you see a description of how the Jews are under attack by their enemies. There's an assembly of kings who attack the Jews in the time of Yahushua. Vayetzu heim v'chol machaneihem imam they. These kings came out with their camps. Am rav kachol asher al sfas hayam larov. Many, many, many people, many, many, many attackers, like the sand at the sea, are attacking the Jews. And again, in Shoftim chapter 7, sentence 12, this is when we are under attack by Midian. And Midian, along with Amalek and the Bnei Kedem, attack Noflim Be'emek Ka'ar Bela Rov. They are like locusts. There are so many of them. And it continues to say, V'lik Malehem Ein Mispar. There are innumerable camels. Kachol shal svas hayam larov, many like the sand at the sea, the same phrase. And then finally, Shmuel Aleph, chapter 13, in which the Plishtim attack the Jews, and they invade, and they are again, like the chol al hayam, they are also like the sand at the sea. So this is an image of a multitude, and specifically a fulfillment of a divine promise by giving that to us, that we should become so many. Hashem has created the utopia that He promised us ages ago, and that goes along not just with having many, but also it goes along with ochlin vishosin usmechin. They are eating, and they are drinking, and they are merry. And my gut, when I read that at first, is to cringe a little bit. Because I thought, Tanakh is supposed to be about more than that. Is that really our goal in life? Eat, drink, and be merry? I'm pretty sure I've heard that line somewhere. It's not one that we're supposed to, emulate. So what is that about? So three approaches. First approach would be to say, you know, joy is what you make of it. Joy is what you make of it. The phrase ochlin v'shosin usmeichin, eating and drinking and rejoicing, is used by Chazal, by our sages, to describe people who are enjoying divine reward, people who are engaged in the joy of a mitzvah. In other words, eating and drinking and being merry doesn't have to be a bad thing. It could actually be a good thing. They are rejoicing in mitzvahs. That's one way to take it. Second way to take the line is to say this is really about the utopia that has arrived, which I keep talking about. And I gave you in source number 8 passage from before things get bad in Parshas Kisavo. Remember that Hashem made a covenant with the Jews when they seemed like they were about to enter the land of Israel, the end of the book of Vayikra, Parshas Bechukosai. And He said, if you do what you're supposed to do, all the following wonderful things will happen to you. And if you don't do what you're supposed to do, then we get the Tochacha and these terrible warnings of disaster. Then we leave Har Sinai, we start to travel, we send the spies, and we end up with 40 years in the wilderness. Fast forward to the end of the 40, and in Parshas Kisavo, Hashem tries again. And He says, okay, here we go, you're going to enter the land. And if you do what is good, here's what you're going to get. And it's source number 8. V'hayayim shamoa tishma b'kol Hashem Elokecha. If you will listen to the voice of Hashem your God, lishmor la'asos es kol mitzvosav, to do all His mitzvos, asher anochi mitzamcha hayam, which I command you today, unusanacha Hashem Elokecha elyon al kol goyei ha'aretz, God will elevate you over all the nations of the land. Uvao alecha kol habrachos ha'ele v'hisigucha, all of these blessings will come upon you, and they will catch you in a good way. Kisishma b'kol Hashem Elokecha, when you listen to the voice of Hashem your God, and He says, you'll be blessed in the city, you'll be blessed in the fields, your young will be blessed, the fruit of your land will be blessed, the fruit of your animals will be blessed, everything will do wonderfully. Your basket that you collect with will be blessed, you'll be blessed when you enter, you'll be blessed when you go out. That's what we're talking about. Ochlin v'shosin usmeichin, you will eat, you will drink, and you will be merry. Hashem has Hashem has promised us plenty, and here it is. In fact, Professor Yehuda Kiel, in the Dot Mikra edition, points out in his introduction something very interesting. The word that we use here for being happy, right, sameach, shows up multiple times in the book of Malachim, but almost exclusively about the reign of Shlomo, of King David. Almost exclusively, you'll see one that's not, and that really is also. If you take a look on your list in source number 9, we can just flip through and see for ourselves. The first use of the word simcha, of the word joy, showed up back in chapter 1. It showed up twice. Chapter 1, sentence 40, sentence 45. Describing the coronation of Shlomo. Everybody is there. Mechalim b'chalilim smechim simcha gedola v'tibaka ha'aretz b'kolam. Everybody is really, really happy. And then again in sentence 45, v'ya'alu misham smechim. Everybody comes up from that coronation. They are smechim. They are rejoicing. Then, chapter 4, sentence 20 is the one that we just read that describes them being happy. Then in chapter 5, sentence 21, we find out Hiram, the king of Tzor, who we just mentioned before, he's the king up in Tyre. He hears about Shlomo, Vayismach Me'od, and he is very happy. The next one, chapter 8, sentence 66, the dedication of the temple, of the Beis HaMikdash. The end of the dedication, the people go home, smechim v'tovei lev, happy and of good heart. And then the next use is in Malachim Bet, and chapter 11 there, and that is after Queen Atalia has tried to wipe out the Davidic line, and then she is defeated, and they survive, and the nation is once again smechim, they're happy that the house of David survives. That's the only one that's not exactly about Shlomo. It's about the Davidic line. But nonetheless, the point remains. Simcha here is God has established the house of David and he has given them the plenty that he promised. That's the second approach. Again, we're answering the question of how you could emphasize mundane eating and drinking like this. The first approach is, yeah, but they're doing it for a mitzvah purpose. They're doing it with positive intentions. Second approach is that it's a response to divine support for the house of David and divine provision of plenty. And then finally, last point, that God has saved us. It's a reaction to divine benevolence. If you take a look at source number 10, Ralbag, in his 11th lesson on this section, says, Ha'achadasar, the 11th lesson is, Hulafarsem shekivo kiyum Hashem yisbarach mashi ye'ed lahaniach liYisrael mikol oyveihem. That when we reach the stage where Hashem has saved Israel from all of their enemies, Ulezesi per shekvar yashav Yehuda v'Yisrael lavetach, Yehuda and Yisrael are sitting securely, ish tachas gapno u'te'enaso, each one under his grapevine, his fig tree. We'll see that phrase in chapter 5. Kol yimei Shlomo, all the days of Solomon. Ulezos hasibad beirech Shlomo Hashem Yisbarach. And so Shlomo blessed God, Asher nasa menucha lamo Yisrael, kechol asher diber, who gave rest to his nation Israel, fulfilling all that he had said. The blessing that he gives to God is one we haven't seen yet. We'll see it later on. But the point is that this is a reaction. This joy is a reaction to divine benevolence. It's a good joy because it is the joy of, wow, Hashem has given us things. Hashem has made us safe. So three kinds of joy. Mitzvah joy, joy of the utopian house of David, and joy of Hashem has taken care of us. And that wraps the chapter. There's so much good going on. And then you have that one note of that Gemara about Elichoreph and Achiyah saying, yeah, but there's a little arrogance there. That you have a king who thinks he can outwit the angel of death. Keep an eye on that one. Okay, questions, comments? Ricky?
Isn't there a little bit of a danger in being too comfortable?
Yeah.
Other than arrogance is also just letting go of things. And
yeah, there is a possibility. There is such a possibility. I don't know if I'd call it foreboding, just because we don't find the Jews sinning in this entire story. It's Shlomo is the problem. We don't find the Jews becoming the problem, which I think is interesting. That chicken does not come home to roost, is what I would say.
Who is the Navi in this time?
Yirmiyahu is the one who records Sefer Malachim, but we will find Shlomo have encounters with Nevi'im. Achya Shiloni is one. We'll see named Nevi'im. Yirmiyahu is not alive at this stage. He's recording this much later.
No one is warning them of too much complacency.
Yeah, right now we're not getting such a message. No, right now we're good. Okay, I see a bunch of hands. Okay, I'm going to take Rose first because she's been waiting a while. Then Ruth, Janine, and Dahlia based on the order in which I saw you. Rose.
Charged a lot of taxes. He taxed everything.
Not yet. Not yet. That's coming at the end.
That was my question.
Okay. Yeah, that's coming at the end of Shlomo's career. Right now, everybody seems good with it. Okay, so I got two for the price of one. That was Rose and Dahlia. Was it Janine and then Ruth?
It just, first of all, the word Vayavlu Vayishtu is not in a negative manner about the Atzilim when Moshe went up. So you wonder. But I, on the opposite, but it's showing a utopia. I was thinking if Yirmiyahu wrote this, it might have been also in light of what happened in later years and the tragedies and the sins of the Jews and the punishments. Maybe this was a showing this, there was a time of utopia where you deserved this and where you had this and maybe hope that you'll have it again.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think this is being held up as a model. In case Jews forget that there was a time when things were good, you know, go look at this story. Look how things are here. It's wonderful. It's amazing. Shlomo's in charge, and everybody's, you know, got a full belly. It's wonderful. Agreed. Ruth?
Rather than look at it from the negative point of view, eating, drinking, and making merry is what you do when your work is done. At the end of the harvest, at the end of building something, you come together as a community. It can be a very positive thing.
Right. No, absolutely agreed. And we'll see that.
I don't see why it has to be negative from some people's point of view.
No, so I think it's true. And we're going to see that when they finish building the Beis HaMikdash, when they dedicate and they celebrate for 2 weeks there, we'll see exactly that. But I think that the reason why people look at this with a suspicious eye is, first of all, because no achievement has been identified here. It's not like they did anything. It's just, hey, we got money suddenly. There's no indication of a virtue that underlay this. And I think that causes suspicion. And also because we know the history of the Jewish people. We know where things like this go. And that's a concern as well. Bruria and then Moish.
I was just wondering when it talks about like the sand, in terms of numbers, do we have any ideas what the numbers were? How many people were at the time?
Nope.
Okay.
Innumerable is what we mean when we say it, and from a historical perspective, I have not the slightest idea.
Okay.
Yeah. Moish. You're muted.
You're muted, Moish.
Shvechiva Tovei Lev reminds me of the beautiful midrash that this was the one Yom Kippur that was at the Khan.
Right, so we're going to get there eventually, but you have a few chapters to go, so hang in there. We're not there yet. Okay. I know. I know you will appreciate it. Absolutely. Okay. So what we have at this stage is prosperity. It's wonderful. It's unbelievable. We're thrilled. And then we get to chapter 5, and it doesn't stop. Like, I know, everyone's expecting me to say, and then, you know, chapter 5, everything just becomes terrible. But it's not true.